Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Hi, Brian Lehrer here, and we're trying something new, packaging three of our favorite segments from the week for you to listen to on the weekend in case you missed them. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. Have a great weekend. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and I'm very happy now to welcome to our studio Armando Iannucci, the man behind some of the best political satire of our day, to be sure. And if you don't know his name, you likely know at least some of his work, starting with creating characters like Alan Partridge and shows like The Thick of It in his native England. The Thick of It was turned into the movie In the Loop, a fictitious account of two bumbling administrations, the UK and the US, trying to come up with a pretext for military action in the Middle East. Okay, maybe it was not that fictitious. And Iannucci's latest project, the HBO series Veep, which is in the middle of its third season now, airing Sundays at 10:30 p.m., is also available through your ex-roommate's HBO Go account. Armando Iannucci, so great to have you here. Welcome to WNYC.
I'm not sure I can endorse the doing of HBO out of its money. But
but you attended the White House Correspondents' Dinner, so we'll get to that.
Yeah.
But I really want to start by congratulating you on Veep, which recently got renewed for a fourth season. And I guess job security in television is a little different from at least American politics, where you can become a congressman and then have your district gerrymandered so you don't have to worry about your job for the next 30 years.
Yeah, the other thing I've noticed about D.C. is even if you're out of power, if your administration isn't in – even if you leave the administration in disgrace, if you resign – you still stay in D.C. and become quite a considerable player. It's a whole industry there.
More and more. I was just reading a stat about the rate of members of Congress who go home after they finish their terms for whatever reason compared to those who actually stay and become professional lobbyists.
Yes.
And the rate has skyrocketed compared to what it used to be.
Yes. And the other thing, of course, is because the Obama administration doesn't allow lobbyists in the White House and doesn't and I think there's a rule now that if anyone leaves the West Wing, there has to be at least 2 years before they become a lobbyist. So all that happens is people leave 2 years earlier than they planned so that they can start making that money on target.
I think that happens. Let's take a listen to a bit from Veep. This is from the first episode of the first season. Vice President Selina Myers is in a meeting with a senator, but then gets news that one of her staffers has messed up. So we pick this clip up when she leaves her office, closes the door behind her, and chews out her assistant.
What the f***, Amy? I am putting out two fires in there, and I turn around to find out that you have set fire to the fire truck? The level of incompetence in this office is staggering.
We are going to get the card back and replace it with a new one.
Yeah, that's right. Simple. You're going to get on it. You are going to shut this the f*** down, okay? Because I am busy in there apologizing to that f***tard. God! Okay. Mr. Burton? I'm so sorry. We're having a complicated day here.
So Julia Louis-Dreyfus as Vice President Selina Myers and her chief of staff. And that's funny on its own. But what the listeners don't know, unless they knew the episode, I guess we can't call it a spoiler if it aired in the first episode of season one. Yeah. But I'd say the reveal is that the stakes aren't that high for how upset she is. What's the assistant or the chief of staff getting chewed out over?
All she's done was a senator has died and there's a condolence card doing the rounds and someone has brought it for the vice president to sign. And the chief of staff has said she's very busy. I'll sign it with her. I'll forge her signature. But she herself is so busy that she doesn't look at what she's doing. And instead of signing Selena's name, she signs her own name. So it looks now that the widow of this dead senator has been demeaned by the fact that the chief of staff has signed the card instead of the vice president. And it really, the reason they're getting so uptight is that Washington is so wound up by the whole status anxiety. You know, I'm sure at the funeral they had of this dead senator, there was a whole round of calls made as to who was going to speak and who wasn't. I'm told if people are invited to Christmas parties at the White House, they'll say, are we going to the 5:30 or the 8 o'clock one? Because the 8 o'clock one is the one you want to be in, not the 5:30. You know, things like that. There's such a kind of level of obsession about where they come in the pecking order.
It sounds like Mark Leibovich's book, This Town, the subtitle of which included two parties and a funeral. And
yeah.
Regarding Tim Russert's funeral, it was partly about exactly that kind of thing.
And yeah, in the first episode of the current season of Veep, she attends a congressman's funeral. She wasn't invited, but she drops by. And they bump an ex-presidential candidate who was going to do the eulogy for her, since she's a sitting vice president. And he just gets to read out a children's poem instead. And that's based on that kind of paranoia about where you are, what your ranking is.
So thinking about this in the context of your work, your series The Thick of It was about the Minister of Department of Social Affairs and Citizenship, sort of mid-level cabinet position. In the Loop is about the Minister for International Development getting in over his head.
Yeah.
And Veep is about the vice president, not the president.
Mm.
Many people write political fiction so they get to put words in the mouths of the most powerful people in the world. Is there a reason that you tend to write about people lower down on the food chain?
Only in that I want to know what really goes on. And I want the audience to know what really goes on. And in any of these large buildings in Washington, these grand, you know, there are hundreds of people in there. So there isn't one person making all the decisions. That's the great sort of hidden trick with power, really, is that it looks like one person is in charge when there is, in fact, 500 people in charge. And they're all extremely busy. So no one really has much time to decide things. And that's what I want to show. I want to show how all the underlings actually have just as much influence or do as much damage
yeah.
as anyone higher up.
And we could think of your show in a way as an inverse of West Wing. Because there, everything was spun to epic proportions. I think your shows tend to be sort of the opposite, with an incessant focus on the petty things. Are you going for that on purpose?
Well, it's also to do with the fact that no matter how principled you are and no matter how idealistic you are, you have to come to terms with the situation you're in, the process, the grind that you have to get through on a daily basis to get anything done. And also the fact that events aren't things that you can schedule or that you can predict. And once that happens, you start finding little corners of your principles being rounded off and little edges of your high ideals being rubbed smooth. And really what I want to show is how no matter how good your intentions are, you're going to be put in a situation where you will inevitably have to compromise and how those compromises come about.
Would you say that in that context, your work is more cynical than West Wing, which I think showed all of what you just described, but in the context of people really trying to do good?
Yes.
And I'm not sure we see that so much in your stuff.
No, although I would say that The person I think you have sympathy for is the elected politician, is the vice president, because she does start each episode with quite a firm set of resolutions, and then they are just frustrated or hampered by the people she has around her and the 24-hour media, who will then seize on any little slight infelicity and magnify it, or the fact that the electorate themselves now expect our politicians to be absolutely perfect, not to have any little faults, to be able to answer any question perfectly and have a perfectly rounded opinion at any time of day or night.
Did you like West Wing? Were you influenced by it? Were you reacting against it with Veep?
No, I loved West Wing. I loved it. For me, it felt very authentic. It felt like an eye opener into the how life goes on in DC. I also loved it for the language, for the the audacity in having such great literary style applied to mainstream drama. Obviously the performances as well, the cast were fantastic. So I was inspired by West Wing. But of course, you don't want to do the thing that you've just seen done, you know, if you're making something. So I wanted to do something different. I thought, okay, that's a very idealized, hopeful, optimistic vision of Washington. I think now, 15 years on, there is much more, from the public, there's a much more sense of disconnection with politicians and from Washington.
Right. That was of its time, and this is of your time.
There's a frustration. There's a feeling that they're all talking about one thing, but it's not the thing that we want to talk about. If you look at how there was a swelling of popular opinion about reform and gun control and how that went away, how, in fact, actually, if you ask people, what are your real concerns? It's not really Obamacare. It's the economy. It's jobs. But, you know, the airwaves are full of, you know, still discussions about. And I think it's that sense of not being invited to the party anymore, that they were no longer part of that conversation.
Satire about a very serious situation of disenfranchisement as people are feeling it around the land. Armando Iannucci, our guest, you know his work from The Thick of It, In the Loop, Veep, Alan Partridge. Can you talk a little bit about how you portray the media landscape in your work? Because I think there are lots of times in your shows when reporters are sort of the most no-nonsense people around. And yet, in this season of Veep, for instance, there's that send-up of the sort of DC inside the Beltway gossip blogger. Yeah. So how culpable are the media in the silliness you try to represent, and how much do you actually admire what goes on in real political journalism?
And well, my great frustration is because journalists themselves, and I've been a journalist myself, so I'm very much aware of it, because they're under pressure now to keep the blogs going, to update their web entries every hour, to come up with content continually, we're beginning to lose that ability to stand back and do the much more long-term assessment, to ask bigger questions, to say, why is this happening? How have we reached this situation? Is gridlock going to get worse? We have to respond to the day and to the minute. And therefore, it seems bizarre to say, no, I want to do something about the last 5 years. That's my frustration.
Do you think this is worse in the United States than in the UK where you live? Because, you know, I could take calls all day from people who say, oh, if only we lived in England, where they have the BBC and they have the Guardian, or is it really the same?
Well, you talk to a BBC journalist or a Guardian journalist who suddenly has to haul a video camera around with him or herself wherever they go, and have to make 3 video pieces as well as 2 blog entries that are updated and file a report. And I think what I've noticed in America, obviously, it's a bigger audience. You know, it's a huge population, so the media is much more widespread. And making a show, Veep is my first TV show in America, and I was amazed by the level of commentary you get the next day on all these highly regarded websites.
Uh-huh.
Whole essays about analyzing each episode. I don't know how these people find the time or earn their money, but it's an industry that we don't have in the UK.
That didn't happen over there with The Thick of It or whatever?
Occasionally, maybe a newspaper review, but not to the level, not to the extent here where it's like it's a sort of noise. It's more than a chatter. It's a sort of.
And do you think that's just the size of our country, or is it different culture?
Well, it's both, but I think the size. You forget, or one forgets when you come over to America, how big the audience is and the potential is, and therefore, actually, everything is magnified. So.
You attended the White House Correspondents' Dinner the other night. Was that your first time?
That was the first time, yeah.
How did that scene strike you? Because our listeners know we did a segment on Monday just after it with Bob Garfield from On the Media and Mark Leibovich from The Times, whose book is Takedown of Washington I mentioned before, and they held this mock media ethics colloquy simultaneously to the dinner in the same hotel. And, of course, nobody showed up, which was the point that they wanted to make. But they think the whole thing shows journalists cavorting too cozily with the politicians they're supposed to be covering.
Well, it's extraordinary. I'd been warned well in advance what would happen when we attended, given that Veep is, you know, watched avidly in D.C. And it was, you know, I was all right because I'm off camera, but the cast were, you know, they were hugely enjoying it. But I did watch them being moved physically by the politicals there who felt that they were their property. And were being, you know, I'd be talking to, you know, Reed Scott, who plays Dan in Veep, and he'd suddenly be yanked away from me by some guy who he'd never met before, who's taking a selfie with him, and then shoved back, you know.
By a politician?
Yeah, or a staffer, or a, you know, uh-huh. But I'd been warned about that. There is in Washington an obsession with anyone from show business who's come to portray them. I think they get quite excited by that. When we were very first shown around the West Wing, as we were making Veep, I just wanted to have a look around just to get a sense of the size of it and the look
real
of it.
West Wing, the real White House,
which is much smaller and more of a warren of small rooms and corridors than you get in the TV show, The West Wing. But the person showing me around showed me into the Roosevelt Room, and he'd say, "This is Roosevelt Room. This would be where CJ would meet with Josh." You know, he was referencing TV West Wing characters, and I'm thinking, "But you're real. You don't have to reference these are actors."
I don't know whether that's funny or terrifying.
Well, that's the thing, you know. It's but I've noticed this. They like to compare themselves to the fictional version.
And I understand that you did a video based on the White House Correspondents' Dinner that takes place, a scene with Julie Louis-Dreyfus and Joe Biden.
That's right. They go. It's like a Ferris Bueller's Day Off, and they go out. They're not going to the Correspondents' Dinner, so the vice president drives Julie around in his Corvette.
They ditch the Correspondents' Dinner and go hang out, right?
Yeah, and they go and get.
Is that the premise?
They go and get. They steal some ice cream in the White House kitchen until Michelle Obama comes in and kicks them out, and then they go to a tattoo joint and get tattooed along with Nancy Pelosi.
She participated too?
Yes. She had a tattoo of Gavel Time. And then they ring up John Boehner and ask if he's coming, and he says no, he's got lots of work to do. And we see he's just watching footage of pandas on the National Geographic Channel.
You may be the only person in the last 2 years to get John Boehner and Nancy Pelosi to cooperate on a project.
Well, that's it. I think that video is possibly the biggest breakthrough in bipartisanship in the last 15 years. It hasn't achieved anything, but it's certainly kind of shown that it can be done.
That's the biggest breakthrough. But also in that video, Biden kind of plays, and by the way, folks, we've put a link to it on our website. You can see it right at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. And Biden sort of plays the Joe Biden that the rest of the world, or at least the internet, I think wishes was the real Joe Biden. He drives a convertible. He flashes a smile.
Yeah.
So what kind of direction did you give him?
Oh, I wasn't there for the shoot. It's a fantastic director called Maurice Mirabeau, who has done stuff for HBO. He was there, and it was very, very, you know, you haven't got much time. That's the thing. To get into these places like the Oval Office and, you know, the West Wing, you're not going to be there for hours and hours and hours. You've got 15 minutes. These people don't have very much time. Right. You know, they turn up and they themselves are very helpful and cooperative, but, you know, there's other stuff to do. In fact, Chris Addison, one of the writers who was out there, was telling me Maurice asked the vice president if he could do one more take, and he said, yeah, sure. He said, you'll know when I've run out of time because a helicopter comes down. And everyone laughed because they thought that was just a joke. But sure enough, 10 minutes later, a helicopter came down.
We're almost out of time with Armando Iannucci, creator of Veep, and Alan Partridge and other stuff. And I just want to play this clip of Malcolm Tucker, the hard-nosed press secretary from your series, The Thick of It. This is about 20 seconds.
Come on, Malcolm. He asked me for a personal opinion.
But why didn't you say? I mean, he asked, fuck. Of course, that explains it. Yeah. See if he'd ask you to fucking black up, or to give him your PIN number, or to yourself. Would you have done that as well?
I would have blacked up because it was radio. Nobody would have known.
Very good, yeah.
Minister?
Not the time, love. I'm busy. Off. Fetus boy. Lesson one. I tell you off, what do you do?
F off?
You'll go far. Well, off.
Why wasn't I told about this?
Why the would I tell you about it? I've told you to off twice and yet you're still here.
You should tell me about it because it's a scheduled media appearance by this department's Secretary of State, so therefore it falls well within my purview.
Within your purview?
Yes.
Where do you think you are? In some Regency costume drama? This is a government department, not a Jane Austen novel.
Malcolm.
Allow me to pop a jaunty little bonnet on your purview and ram out of the with a lubricated horse.
So, Armando Iannucci, you were thoroughly entertained by your own work there.
Well, no, it's just the level of beeping there. It just makes it something else.
Yes. So, and we did that. We chose that clip on purpose. It is, of course, hard to find an FCC-friendly clip of Malcolm Tucker. And if I've got this bit of your bio right, you once wanted to be a priest. So somehow you went from priest wannabe to somebody who can write that kind of foul-mouthed, insult-heavy dialogue. Do you hire writers for their ability to diss for Malcolm Tucker?
Well, it's always great fun. Yeah, there's a whole team of writers, and it's always when we've done a bit of hard work on the script and the plot and so on, just as a sort of relaxation at the end of the day, we write sweary dialogue for Malcolm Tucker. And similarly for Veep, we write graphic insults for Jonah. That's our little reward we give ourselves at the end of the day.
Yeah, and you get paid for that.
Oh, yeah.
So last thing, I wonder if you've noticed your work having an influence on the real political landscape. Like, there are people in the Obama administration who got their taste of politics from the West Wing and are measuring their real-life high-stakes experience against a fictitious TV show. Do you meet people who say they want to be the Malcolm Tucker or, more recently, the Selena Myers of the real world?
Well, some Malcolm Tucker insults have now made themselves into the political lexicon in the UK. The budget from last year was called an omni-shambles by the leader of the opposition, which was a quote from the thick of it. And also some pieces of legislation that we invented in our shows 5 or 6 years ago have now actually become law.
Really? Like what? You actually have one?
National Spare Room Database. And behavior orders on pets is another one that came in. It's just
what does that mean? Behavior orders on
pets?
Well,
if you have a dog that's very loud, that may have bitten someone, it can have a restraining order slapped on it. So I don't think it's in the long scheme of things. I don't think we're going to affect the world economy. But
Armando Iannucci, creator of Veep, in its third season and now renewed for a fourth. Congratulations. Thank you very much for joining us. It's been fun.
Pleasure. Thank you very much.
Brian Lehrer and WNYC.
The natural migration will be towards the studio one-bedroom apartments where the real crisis is for families. I mean, I think that the price of a two-bedroom apartment has become a sort of form of birth control in Manhattan.
The price of a two-bedroom apartment has become a form of birth control in Manhattan, said a caller to the show, Jessica Manhattan, from a few weeks ago. It's a family meeting on rent on the Brian Lehrer Show today. And we use that clip as prelude to ask, will the de Blasio affordable housing plan stop the crazy rent inflation in New York City? We are happy to have Deputy Mayor Alicia Glenn with us on the city's ambitious new blueprint. Deputy Mayor, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian.
The Bloomberg administration had its voluntary 80-20 formula, offering developers more height on their buildings in exchange for 20% of the apartments being made affordable. You're going for a different ratio, where the goal for many advocates is often more like 20-30-50. Is something like 20-30-50 your numerical goal?
Well, I think that, you know, we've been very clear that what we need to do is have a much more mixed income approach when we are using all of our housing tools. And I think it's important for the listeners to understand that there is the inclusionary piece of that, which currently under the voluntary program, it is a 20% set aside for affordable housing when you voluntarily do inclusionary housing. But there are many, many other programmatic requirements that stem from the way housing is financed that also have led to that 80-20 sort of in the ether. So that's also how our tax exemptions have been working and how much of the federal funding has come down, which in- encourages the 80-20 model. You know, one of the things we're very focused on is making sure that we can serve a much wider range of incomes. And so what the plan lays out is really specific targets to make sure that our most low-income families as well as our middle-income families have an opportunity to share in the affordable housing agenda.
So something like 20, 30, 50 means 20% for really low-income people, 30 kind of middle-moderate income housing, and 50% market rate?
Well, that's one model, and there are some examples of that right now. Actually, where the mayor made his announcement in Brooklyn yesterday is a 50-30-20 of that model that's going into the ground right now. We also lay out in the plan that we want to play with some other variations of that. We really think there isn't a one-size-fits-all. You know, we are going to look at different types of 50-30-20s where even the 50 may be capped at middle-income rents, and there wouldn't actually be a market rate component. I think when you look at the various neighborhoods and the needs in the neighborhoods, we're going to have to align our various incentive programs to really respond to the needs of the market and the neighborhoods. So again, it's getting away from a one-size-fits-all approach and really working to understand what the market conditions are and who the populations are in the various neighborhoods, because we are committed to serving a much wider range of folks.
So on the market conditions in the city as a whole, the New York Times article on the plan today says some cities such as Boston and Denver already require projects over a certain size to set aside affordable units. Mm-hmm. But housing experts say there's a downside. The requirement can reduce or eliminate profits and dissuade developers from building, says the Times. So why won't this mandatory inclusionary zoning mean a higher percentage of affordable apartments, but in a context of less new supply overall, because developers won't have the incentive to build that they did before, than if you did nothing?
Well, I mean, I think it's a very complex question with respect to where the market is at any given time. But what we are going to be doing is not over the next couple of months, you know, imposing a mandatory inclusionary requirement across the city. That is not the way that the program will be rolled out. Neighborhood by neighborhood, the city is going to be working with communities to rezone neighborhoods where we think that there are opportunities to build significant housing and mixed-use projects. And when the city then upzones or rezones those neighborhoods and creates that value, we will be looking at what the market conditions are and make sure that the ratios that we impose are not going to create a tipping point where we're disincentivizing development. The mayor has been very clear that we are pro-development and that part of our density agenda is to capture what is an incredibly strong market here and make sure that those neighborhoods where we are creating density and opportunity for folks includes a fair percentage of affordable housing. So we don't think, and we certainly have no intention of designing a program where the tipping point would be reached, because then we would be undermining our own objectives.
So 200,000 units to be created or preserved over the next decade. It sounds like a lot. The Times editorial on this calls it de Blasio's moonshot, because that number is seen as so high. But I see that most of that is housing to be preserved, and only 80,000 additional affordable units compared to today over the next 10 years in a city of 8 million people. That barely keeps up with population growth and isn't enough to change the basic picture of affordability, is it?
Well, I mean, I would say a couple of things. One, the 200,000 units is the most ambitious affordable housing plan ever proposed by a municipality in the country. So that's the affordable stock, not our overall production targets. Second of all, I think to say that, you know, we are overemphasizing preservation is not, in fact, correct. 120,000 units to be preserved is an extraordinary opportunity to make sure that we can maintain the income diversity that really is the backbone of the city and protect decades and decades of public sector investment, but also decades and decades of people committing to those neighborhoods and staying in those buildings. So we can't de-emphasize the fact that really aggressively going out and preserving housing that has either been subsidized or has been subject to regulation stays in the system is incredibly important. As you've seen, the data shows that the number of units that have gone out of regulation over the past decade has really accelerated the problem. And so we are fundamentally committed to making sure that that housing stays in the system.
Right.
And then on the new construction side, Brian, yes. 80,000 units of new affordable housing is an extraordinary increase over any other city's attempt to ever build that much affordable housing, and a significant increase over both the Bloomberg plan and the Koch plans, which were focused mostly on rehabilitation and not increasing the overall stock.
Right. And my question is not intended to suggest that you're not being as ambitious as you think you can possibly be, but just to reflect how difficult it is to really change the landscape. I mean, the Bloomberg administration created or preserved 165,000 over 12 years, and look how much higher the average rents are anyway than when they came in. So my question is, with all that you can do, with all the billions you can throw into it and trying to squeeze money out of Albany and Washington and everything else, is this just a matter of 80,000 more families winning lotteries for affordable units that will remain scarce in a city built for luxury?
Well, I mean, I think to say just 80,000 units is, again, de-minimizing how much of a dent we think this will make into the existing problem. I mean, 80,000 units will translate into housing for close to 250,000 people, and that's an extraordinary undertaking. And it's not just a question of winning a lottery. We're going to have a very, very systemic approach to where we're building this housing, working with neighborhoods to identify whether the needs are for senior housing and smaller units or whether we need to be driving production for larger families, because one of the things that we've seen is that because the housing stock no longer accurately reflects the demographic makeup of the city, is that we may, in fact, if we do this correctly, be able to free up additional housing that is already in the stock, right? So the classic example of seniors in particular who may be staying in a one- or two-bedroom apartment because there are no viable alternatives, if we can create a way in which people can be housed in the type of housing that they should be at this stage of their own projection, we should then be able to also ease some of the backlog. So we're really trying to be thoughtful about the whole housing ecosystem here and think about who are New Yorkers today, who are going to be the New Yorkers over the next decade, and understand that the affordable housing agenda is obviously only one piece of that puzzle. We need to continue to work with the real estate industry so that we can streamline our processes. We're going to be removing various barriers to construction and to the zoning process in order to make it easier for people to build, because if we do this right, for every affordable unit, we should also be seeing an increase in the market rate stock so that we can begin to really make a dent in the overall housing crisis.
And when you talk about making it easier to build, I saw you say on New York One last night, or maybe it was your colleague Vicky Bean, I'm not sure which of you it was, that you've had constructive conversations between union and non-union builders, and that to be affordable to rent, housing has to be affordable to build, and that unions are open to taking some lower wages. So is this administration, which is famous for trying to increase the minimum and living wages in New York, trying to lower wages of construction workers as part of this plan?
Well, absolutely not. I mean, I think that what is extraordinary about this whole effort is that everybody in the city and sets of people who historically have not all come together around these issues are prepared to come to the table around these issues because the crisis has really reached a new high. So that if 55% of New Yorkers are technically rent burdened, and that means they're paying more than one-third of their income on housing alone, everybody has an interest to sit down and figure out how to do this. The disparity between what the union labor costs are and what non-union labor costs are, you know, does have a real impact on our ability to drive forward on the plan. And so the fact that the unions are meeting with developers and advocates to talk about identifying a wage rate that would allow them to participate more fully in the program is a fantastic step forward. That said, even if the city finances housing that is not built by unions, we absolutely will have at least a living wage as our standard. There's a big gap between a living wage and a union wage, and we think that if we can reach some middle point there, we will actually see increased production, lower costs, and quality jobs being created for folks who can then not just participate in building the affordable housing plan, but then also have the skills they need to grow into the trades and work on non-residential projects, for example. So we think this is a real opportunity to link the economic development engine of a $41 billion plan to other goals around skills building, growing the workforce, integrating the workforce into our other programs, so that it's a real win for New Yorkers.
But just to finish that point, are you suggesting that there's a middle wage between the living wage, which is still relatively low, and the union wage, and so that union wage needs to come down for some of these coming projects?
Well, I mean, what I'm saying is, and we've been having conversations with various members of the trades, and they recognize that they have a real interest in opening up their ranks and participating in this program in a way that they historically have not, and that because of the scope of this agenda and the different building typologies, they have indicated a willingness to talk about a wage reduction for their members that would allow them to have more people coming into the unions, create more apprenticeships, and have really a much bigger impact on the plan. Mm-hmm. So we're not taking a position on exactly what that wage rate should be, but they have indicated to us a willingness to really reduce their base wage when we're talking about constructing affordable housing, and we really welcome that.
Interesting. Deputy Mayor Alicia Glenn, as we talk about the de Blasio administration's new affordable housing blueprint, and one key to this is convincing neighborhoods that density is good. Mm-hmm. But generally, people don't want more density in their neighborhoods. Who wants the high-rise to go up on the corner of their block in Brownstone, Brooklyn, et cetera? So you say you'll build this from the ground up, neighborhood by neighborhood, in consultation. But will you have to force this on many neighborhoods to reach the production goal?
Absolutely not. I mean, I think we should also redefine what the word density means. I mean, I think that there has been, you know, people associate density now with exactly what you just did, Brian, which is saying there's going to be a tower in my backyard. And when you actually look at what we're talking about with respect to density in many of the neighborhoods where we think there is really fantastic infrastructure and opportunities to do smart development, particularly around where there's access to mass transit, density in those cases can mean going from a 3 or 4 story building to going to a 6 or 8 story building and actually building back to what has been the historical density in many of the boroughs. So we're not talking about shoving towers down people's throats in various neighborhoods. We're talking about working with people to identify corridors and neighborhoods where appropriate densification will result in a huge amount of housing production. And with that housing production comes many of the retail and community services that neighborhoods will be able to embrace as a whole to make those neighborhoods more livable and more vibrant. And so that kind of conversation is going to start right now. The planning department is initiating a whole series of community-based planning studies and will be launching what they expect to be a dozen potential rezoning efforts over the next year, where we will work with the community to say, hey, you know, a 6 to 8 story building plus a supermarket, plus we're organizing our capital planning efforts to make sure that we have the right number of school seats. And we're also going to be able to then justify putting in more open space, investing more in the neighborhood because there is an increase in population. So we really see this as a healthy discussion around what makes these neighborhoods incredibly vital. And by the way, when asked, most people, it's their own neighbors or it's their own families who are desperate for affordable housing. And so when you start talking to folks about the fact that it's their mother or their kid coming back from college who can no longer live, you know, within their own neighborhood or within their own borough, the whole conversation changes really dramatically.
Indeed.
Because it really resonates with folks.
But does density really create more affordability in the long run anyway? Haven't we seen in places like Williamsburg and all over Manhattan that when the higher buildings come in, even with a percentage set aside for affordable, that means gentrification? So market rates rise in the neighborhood as a whole, commercial rents rise, and local merchants get forced out, and there are costs, economic costs to density, not just economic benefits?
Well, I think that, I mean, we do believe very strongly that when we begin to build these neighborhoods and have an array of incomes that are not just very low, but also beginning to create a whole housing resource for folks in the moderate and middle income range, combined with very serious enforcement of rent regulation, we believe that, in fact, we will make a dent in what has become, for many people, you're right, rapidly, rapidly changing neighborhoods, which have set many people, you know, out of their neighborhoods and feeling like, where is my neighborhood? And I think that what we're very focused on is making sure that we're coupling our preservation efforts our new construction efforts and our enforcement efforts in a very proactive and thoughtful way so that we can attack this whole problem in a much more holistic way. I think you're right. Over the past decade, many of the efforts with respect to affordable housing have been linked exclusively to the development of luxury housing, and that affordable housing is a byproduct of luxury housing. And I think it's fair to say that that has not produced what people need to see in the neighborhoods. And so we're very focused on moving away from that paradigm into a much more proactive and comprehensive approach to marrying the preservation piece, the new construction piece, a wider range of incomes, and being very, very aggressive with all of our enforcement tools to make sure that those neighborhoods can stay economically diverse.
It's a great vision if you can pull it off. But let me follow up with one more question.
Sure.
As a progressive administration, do you have to change people's basic notion of what progressive urbanism is? And I don't think the icon of progressive urbanism, Jane Jacobs, for example, was a fan of density. Towers on a plaza as a model for public or private housing has been largely discredited in terms of quality of life. But you're saying you can get landlords to give you enough affordable housing in buildings that are as small as 6 to 8 stories. Can you really, or don't you need to let them build a lot higher than that in many, many cases in order to make the profit that they need to make and then still give you the 20, 30, 50%?
Well, again, the 20, 30, 50% is not the mandatory inclusionary program. I do want folks to understand there are many, many different levers we're going to be using. So it may be that in a district where the maximum you can build to is a 6 or 8 story building, there may be an ability to impose a mandatory requirement that allows us to build a few units there. But we can also be using our other tools in those neighborhoods, and the city is going to be putting a substantial amount of their own capital behind this plan so that we can also help those buildings attain a level of middle income or moderate income housing. I think with respect to the Tower and the Park and the Jane Jacobs issue, I think everybody would agree that those are outdated modes of thinking about what makes a healthy city. And so our view is that to the extent that we can use this housing agenda to create livelier street walls, connect people back into the urban grid, and support better quality retail and community services, that's exactly what we think progressive urbanism is all about, not isolating people in towers in the park, but integrating them back into the lifeblood of the city and reconnecting folks to neighborhoods. So I think, you know, it's obviously very complex, but we think that between using our zoning power, putting our own money behind this plan, working with the state and federal government for them to also participate, and aligning our incentive programs, we can really make a dent in a way that people should be able to feel, you know, within the next couple of years.
A minute left for anything you want to say about the housing blueprint.
No, you know, look, we are incredibly excited about how many stakeholders have come to the table to do this. I mean, unlike previous plans, we've met with hundreds of people ranging from advocates to developers to labor to supportive housing advocates. And we think that this really represents an unbelievable opportunity in the face of a crisis for so many different people to come to the table and be willing to work with us to identify sites to build, neighborhoods to preserve, statutes that we should amend, all with the drive of creating a more affordable, and quite frankly, without having an affordable and diverse city, how are we going to continue to be the global city that we've been to date? Housing is fundamentally the building block of our economy and what makes New York City so great. And so we really look forward to rolling it out over the next decade.
If it works, it'll be a much better city. Deputy Mayor Alicia Glenn, thank you for giving us this time.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and now the 5-mile-an-hour difference. As I said before the break, Vision Zero traffic safety activists were up in Albany yesterday lobbying for a law that would reduce New York City's official speed limit to 20 miles per hour on local streets. Mayor de Blasio wants to lower it too, but to 25. So we will talk to 20 MPH advocate Mary Beth Kelly now about the 5-mile-an-hour difference and also why she wants us to stop referring to car crashes as accidents. Mary Beth Kelly of the group Families for Safe Streets joins us now. Welcome back to WNYC.
Brian, it's a pleasure to be here again.
And full disclosure, I've known you for many years as a supporter of WNYC and as a transportation alternatives board member, and I know that your husband was killed when he was struck on his bicycle back in 2006. I know you're very public about that, and my condolences for that again.
Thank you. Is
Families for Safe Streets largely a coalition of people who have lost loved ones on the roads?
Yes, that's correct. People who have lost a loved one or have seen the aftermath of a crash for a loved one who is struggling with the effects of serious injury.
And this is a new group just formed earlier this year.
That's right.
Is it a coincidence that it's at the same time that Mayor de Blasio is coming out with his Vision Zero and a goal of zero traffic deaths?
I think it is a bit of a coincidence, although I think that's kind of how things happen in the universe. There's sometimes a perfect storm.
So what's the difference between 20 miles an hour and 25 miles an hour, which Mayor de Blasio wants, which would already be a reduction from the current, what is it? Is it 30?
It's 30 now. It's 30, and what we know is that you are 9 times more likely to be killed, hit at 30 miles an hour as a pedestrian than at 20. You have an extra car length if you are a driver to react to the possibility of a crash if you are going 20 miles per hour.
Uh-huh. And so you're saying the stats back up the difference between 30 miles an hour and 25 miles an hour and also 25 miles an hour and 20 miles an hour in ways that you could document.
Yes. In fact, we're not the first to be doing this. Paris, Tokyo, Berlin, London have all gone to 20 miles per hour. And in London, the results are really significant and I think would appeal a great deal to New Yorkers, which is that there's a 47% reduction in death and serious injury on the streets of London since they've lowered it to 20.
So the city council is on your side, right?
That's right.
They've passed a resolution asking Albany for 20.
They are in the process. Yes, and we do have the Transportation Committee of the City Council absolutely 100% behind this.
And so in February, Mayor de Blasio's new Transportation Commissioner, Polly Trottenberg, was on the show, and I asked her about the difference. This begins with my question. That's another proposal, to lower the citywide speed limit from 30 to 25. Now, the City Council proposal would have it go down to 20. So how did you decide on 25?
Well, I want to say, first of all, I think I'm glad to say there is a lot of broad agreement that we need to lower the speed limit in the city. That is, you know, and I think Sam Schwartz said it well on your show, which is the lower the speed, the more likely, if there is some sort of an unfortunate crash, that whoever is involved will survive. I think our city engineers have determined that, again, what you want to do is pick a default speed limit for the city and then mark areas where you're going to make the speed limit either higher or low. And I think they've determined 25 actually makes the most sense. But I think, look, we want to work with a coalition that wants to lower New York's speed limit, and we'll hopefully get to the right place.
Polly Trottenberg, Transportation Commissioner. So it sounds like she wants to work with you.
Yes.
And she didn't actually give a reason there as to why the engineers came up with 25 as opposed to 20. Is it clear to you why the administration, which is philosophically aligned with you, didn't go all the way to 20 miles an hour?
You know, I think it may be that we sometimes fear the wrong things. And when people hear 20, I think it scares them a bit. I think they think, oh, that's too slow for New York. And what we know is that there is no one speed in New York City that fits all. We're not talking about a 20-mile-per-hour speed on arterials. The DOT has set, actually, a 25-mile-per-hour speed on our major roads. They're already in the process of Atlantic Avenue and Northern Boulevard becoming 25-mile-per-hour avenues. But in our neighborhoods, which are densely residential, we need the autonomy from Albany so that we can set those speeds down as low as our community needs it, which the outcry is for 20.
But she said 25 would be the default speed. And then if individual neighborhoods like where I live in Upper Manhattan happens to have established itself as a slow zone, and if they want to reduce it to 20, they can reduce it to 20 at the neighborhood level, right?
Well, you're very fortunate, Brian, that you live in one of those zones.
There are speed bumps every 3 feet,
right,
the whole thing.
Exactly, and that's great. And I'm really glad for you and your children that you have that. But we have a waiting list, 200 applicants waiting. The DOT has said if they do it zone by zone in that manner, it'll take decades to do all the speed bumps, the sign change, the lighting, everything that goes into that. Whereas if we have a default of 20 miles per hour, then we can move up on arterials where it seems like a higher speed is necessary.
Listeners, do you have any opinion about this or any questions? The difference between 20 or 25 miles an hour as a default speed limit for the local roads, as our guest Mary Beth Kelly is making clear, this is not for the BQE, even though you usually can't go more than about 25 miles an hour on the BQE anyway. But, you know, not for the highways. This is for the local roads, a default speed limit of 20 rather than 25. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And we'll get into the language question in a minute, why her group wants to kind of borrow the word accidents from our day-to-day use when it comes to crashes and call them crashes. Mary Beth Kelly of the group Families for Safe Streets. And boy, you know, people love to talk about this stuff. Our lines are already full.
Wow, that's great
to
hear.
So let's take a caller. Anderson in Harlem, you're on WNYC. Good morning. Anderson, are you there? All right, we'll try to get back to Anderson, and we'll try Jeff in Park Slope. Hi, Jeff, you're on the air.
Good morning, Brian. I'm all for lowering the speed limits. I'm a driver. I'm pretty much the only driver in our social circle. I use it to get in and out of Brooklyn to go to visit clients. But the issue to me is not – it's great if we lower the speed limits from 30 to 25, 25 to 20. But what about enforcement? It's not just putting the speed limits and say, hey, we've won. But in our neighborhood – it's, you know, on avenues. I mean, I believe throughout the whole city, the speed limit is 30. But I see people going at 40, 45, 50 miles an hour down 3rd Avenue, 4th Avenue, 5th Avenue. So what are we going to do as far as getting enforcement? Because just because we lower the speed limit, that doesn't mean we're slowing drivers down.
First of all, you know New York City is different from the rest of America when you could be the weird one in your social circle for owning a car. second of all, he's absolutely right, Mary Beth, isn't he? And Police Commissioner Bratton came out, again, on your side, basically, and said he's going to direct cops to make sure they're enforcing the speed limits, right?
Yes, that's right. And we need that very badly. We also need to give the police, I think, more assistance because the speeding is so pervasive. It's a culture of speeding, and that's part of what we're aiming to change, just like Mothers Against Drunk Driving changed a culture that assumed it was okay to drink and drive. In terms of enforcement, we need electronic help. We need speed cameras. We just won 120 additional cameras from Albany. They're all going at school zones. What we found with 20 pilot cameras in 2 weeks' time placed at school zones only operating during school hours, and indeed most speeding takes place at night and on weekends, was that in 2 weeks, 900 tickets for speeding were given out. Now, that means they were all going at least 40 miles per hour because the current speed limit is 30, and the cameras don't ticket you until you're going 10 miles over.
Susan on the Upper West Side, you're on WNYC. Good morning.
Good morning. I've lived in New York for a long time. I've never, ever seen anyone stop for speeding. They go down Broadway as if it's a freeway. However, my point, and I think I'm very unpopular in this regard, people are speeding down Broadway, and people are walking into a side street with traffic going very fast, with dogs and strollers, because they really don't want to have to wait a second. And I feel like I'm the only one standing there waiting for the lights to change. So I just plow into traffic. And I feel very silly and unpopular because everyone else, you know, keeps doing it. And I was at Lincoln Center, and I said to somebody, this woman is walking into traffic with her stroller. And this man said, it's New York. It's New York. Like, get with the program. You're supposed to walk into traffic. It's New York.
Right. And you're not that much of an odd New Yorker out because – again, Mary Beth Kelly, I'll say that one thing callers always bring up in response to street safety policy discussions is pedestrian responsibility. People do cross the streets against the light. People do talk on their cell phones or look down and text while walking, all this stuff. So where does that come in?
Well, what I would say is from the experiences of people who have been hit and those who have been killed, 95% of the time they were in the right, as with my husband. We were in a crosswalk on our bicycles with a green light, and that is the story after story of everyone in Families for Safe Streets. You could be in the right and dead right. In my neighborhood, we had 3 deaths within 1 week's time. One young boy walking with his father, holding hands in a crosswalk. We have one of our members in Flushing, four-year-old girl walking with her grandmother in the crosswalk. I mean, this is the norm, and yet we all have to be vigilant. We have a distracted society. We get distracted easily, and therefore we do have to wake up and pay attention. But this the cause of these serious injuries and deaths, the primary cause is speeding vehicles, not people jaywalking, not people who are distracted.
So how did it go in Albany yesterday?
It went very well. It was quite impressive. We have about 150 people, 3 buses, children, 14 children from the Park Slope area where, fellow student was killed. These are our 12-year-olds. We had students from Lehman College. We had people from all the boroughs on these buses. We lobbied all day long. We had a major press conference, and we got 15 new signers to the Dillon and O'Donnell bills in the Assembly and the Senate for a 20-mile-per-hour default speed limit in New York City.
So do you think the state legislature is going to overrule the de Blasio administration?
Well, what I would say is I hope more of our legislators actually read the bill, because what we found is the biggest problem was for those who had not really read the bill think that this is a 20-mile-per-hour across-the-board speed limit for New York City, which is inaccurate. This is a default.
The governor sometimes likes to one-up Mayor de Blasio. Are you getting him on board? Do you know?
We are determined that we will.
Ben, in Bed-Stuy, you were on this lobbying trip with Mary Beth yesterday?
I was, Brian. And first off, I want to thank Mary Beth and all of the families who have banded together to form Families for Safer Streets. I can't imagine how horrible it is to lose a loved one to traffic violence. And then to move on from that tragedy and become a political force for safer, more livable New York City is really commendable. So thank you, Mary Beth, and all of the other people in that group for your leadership.
Thank you, Ben.
Ben, thank
you're
you
welcome.
Very much. So let's talk about the language issue. You want the media and everybody else. And by the way, it's WNYC news policy to call a crash, not an accident. So just for the record, and I think that's because accident implies that somebody wasn't doing something on purpose, and you don't know that until after the investigation. But give us your rationale on this, because most people might hear this distinction and say, well, come on, unless somebody was trying to commit murder with their car, then it is an accident.
Well, I think the difference is that we're talking about something that's preventable. We're talking about something that we know causes death, high speed. It is the number one cause of serious deaths, and we have upward of 280 of them per year and 4,000 life-altering injuries on our streets a year. We know that speed is the number one cause of that. Second to that is failure to yield. If we can attack the speed issue, that's huge. And to call it a crash says this is something that could have been avoided. An accident, people shrug their shoulders and say, oh, it could have happened to anyone. But it happens to more and more people because we have this speed and because we think of them as accidents that could just happen, like a landslide, like other things in nature, where this is like drinking and driving. It's preventable.
Hi, I'm in Far Rockaway. You're on WNYC. Good morning.
Hello. How are you doing? I wanted to call up just to point out that when you're driving your car at 20 miles an hour, you're actually the gears are shifting back and forth. It's not so good for the car. When you're driving at 25 miles an hour, you're actually locked in better into a gear.
This is a manual shift question, right?
It's actually, I think both cars, the automatic also, will change gears in around 20 miles an hour.
It looks like Mary Beth has heard this before.
You know, one of the things that we have going on in our streets right now is fast, slow, fast, slow, fast, slow. People speed up, slow down, speed up, slow down. At 20 miles per hour, what we have found in other cities is that there's actually a smoother flow of traffic.
Smoother?
A smoother flow. We're not going fast, slow, fast, slow.
Chaim, go ahead.
I'm not just talking about just fast, slow. I'm saying your car at 20 miles an hour is fluctuating, especially like an automatic car will fluctuate between, like, even the 18 to 20 will fluctuate between first and second gear.
I tend to think that saving lives trumps what it does to our cars.
Chaim, thank you for your call. So would they have to change, and has Mayor de Blasio already taken steps to change the default traffic flow without hitting any red lights on the one-way streets? Like, I think it's 30 now, right? If you're going up, say, Amsterdam
right.
Avenue, Madison
That's
Avenue,
right.
any of those that are one-way, you can, if there's not a lot of traffic, you can go for a long time without ever hitting a light. And I think it's set at 30.
It's set at 30. And what's one of the things that was discovered in, let's just say, in my neighborhood, where on Columbus Avenue was turned into a complete street with a protected bike lane, and they narrowed the lanes. And what we have found after 2 years' study is that people get from point A to point B faster, even though the speed might come down, which is a very interesting phenomenon. So I think that when we're looking at this, we have to really consider not just what we're afraid might happen, but what is actually happening when we do these things.
You can never do that hit the light flow thing on Second Avenue, though, because there's always too much traffic. So editorial comment. What comes next for you? And then we're out of time.
Well, I think we have to continue this push in Albany. We want our assembly people and senators to actually read the bills and understand that this is not a one-size-fits-all bill for New York City, and really get behind that and give New York the autonomy to set the speed limit at where it needs to be for our neighborhoods, for the well-being of our New Yorkers.
Mary Beth Kelly from the group Families for Safe Streets. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian.
Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.